Blog Talk Radio.
Clap your hands for Angela.
All right, you're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Today's interview is with Reverend Lionel Gant. Reverend Lionel Gant is part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he has an organization called Stop the Violence and Incarceration, which is part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Its motto and slogan is, "We change the hearts and minds of men," which means woman also. But the first part is they use nonviolent action. Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Stop the Violence and Incarceration, which was started by Reverend Lionel Gant, to stop the violence and incarceration program company. His motto is use education and economic power to counteract the behaviors of those who use crime and violence as a means to create income. So, how are you doing, Reverend Gant?
Hey, man, I'm doing fine. How you doing? It's great to be with you again, Ms. Butler.
It's great to be with you, Pastor Gant. Tell me a little bit about your churches. How many churches do you have started?
I've been affiliated with starting Life in Christ Christian Ministry. From that, another church sprung up, New Life in Christ. And I've been with my pastor, Reverend L.G. Mumford, at the Lamb of God Missionary Baptist Church. And from there, it has split off into another church that is pastored by Reverend Royce Tillman. And it's about five churches all together.
That you've helped to start, that you started yourself.
Yes, ma'am. That I've been, one of them I was affiliated with, and the others I helped start.
Okay, you helped start. Okay. All right, that's wonderful. So, we have a lot to talk about. One of the things you were talking about was being a veteran and the time you spent in the military. And not too long ago, you found out that you suffered from depression. And you thought that you had just been a strong black man. You didn't know you had depression. Tell me about that. Tell everyone about that.
My military career is actually very long. I took 3 years of ROTC in high school, and then I took senior ROTC. I went to Georgia Military College, where I was. Trained in, military occupational skills and military science, rather. And I went on to become a soldier. I went on in the military from there, and I spent the next 21 years, in military service. And I was in the Gulf War. I was in the cleanup campaign after the war in Panama. And I pretty much caught every conflict that we had within that time of my service, over 21 years. And the military concept is that they kind of teach us to take the pain, to take the pain. Do you understand what I'm saying, Ms.
Yes,
Butler?
Sir, I do.
We're kind of trained not to complain. To engage something, overcome it, and keep moving. And as you said, I had gotten to a point where I was so busy being the strong black man and being that strong soldier, veteran type individual that I didn't realize that. I hadn't taken any time to grieve. I hadn't taken any time to take care of myself. I was always, continuing to talk, to charge, and, taking care of everybody else. And yes, I found myself in a state of depression, and I didn't even know that I was suffering from depression at that time. And when I went to the VA, I just had a candid discussion with my social worker, who's a psychologist, and when I told her what I was going through, she actually closed the door and asked me a series of questions, and then she made the diagnosis that, yes, that I was suffering from depression and didn't even know it.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's something else.
A lot of soldiers are suffering from PTSD right now, and a lot of veterans out there, I ask the veterans to please go and get some help. Go and sit down and talk to somebody. Even if you feel like you're all right, you may not be all right, because there's a lot of deep buried emotions that we have that we really need to deal with. And I just wanted to add that in. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead, Reverend Gant. You're welcome on Show Talk with Angela Butler anytime. Your stop the violence and incarceration, is that I'm going to call it a program, a company, LLC, nonprofit, right?
It's actually a campaign. It's a campaign just like the bus boycott, or just like the sit-ins or the different activities that we had. it's just a campaign that we're running at this time to make people aware of violence and make people aware of the mass incarceration of our people. And as you were saying earlier, we try to use the power of education, meaning we want to educate them about these facts, and then we want to use economic empowerment to counteract these facts. And we've been having a success. We've been having 100% success at what we've been doing, because now you see the whole nation is talking about stopping the violence and stopping the mass incarceration of our people.
Yes. Stop the violence and incarceration, part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Am I correct?
Yes, ma'am. Dr. King's organization, our leadership is right now under Dr. Charles Steele and his lovely wife, First Lady Kathleen Steele. She runs the program for Save Our Girls. And long before the 300 girls were kidnapped in Nigeria, long before all these other things were happening, our First Lady, Dr. Kathleen Steele, she was out there saying that, look, we got over 300 girls coming up missing in the United States every day. And they're being, you know, shipped off into human trafficking and sex slavery and all kinds of things that our young girls are coming up missing every day. And we took up that campaign, and all of that works together with our Stop the Violence and Incarceration campaign.
Okay. All right. And that's the Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Would you tell people a little bit about Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference is as you know, an organization that was started by Dr. Martin Luther King, Ralph David Abernathy, Jose Williams, and a host of our leadership, Andrew Young, John Lewis. All of them were part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference back in the day, and they were the ones who got this started. And Dr. Charles Steele, our president right now, he's done a phenomenal job of keeping the organization going. And what he's done right now, he's taken us back to Dr. King's last campaign. As you know, before his assassination, he was working with the garbage men on the garbage man strike. And the name of that campaign, like the Stop the Violence campaign, that name of that campaign was the Poor People's Campaign. And if you listen to the speech that he made, the I Have a Dream speech that they call it now, it was really not about having a dream. It was really an economic speech about America leveling the economic playing field for Black America, because we were denied our 40 acres and a mule at the Emancipation Proclamation. We were denied equal housing opportunities. We were denied equal banking opportunities for its economic opportunities. And he was saying it's time. He said that we have come to the state capital, to the nation's capital, to cash a check. And America has basically given Black America a blank, a bounce check, because they have never fulfilled the financial, economic aspects of our struggle. They have never fulfilled it, and it seemed like they don't have any intentions of fulfilling it. So Dr. Steele took us back to the Poor People's Campaign to work on economic equalization for all of Black America.
Okay. All right. Yes, youth education. You use the power of education and economic empowerment to counteract the behaviors of those who would use crime and violence as a means to create income within the community. We change the heart and minds of. Okay. All right.
Yes.
So.
Yes, I mean, when we say we're using the power of education, you know, I went before the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. This was back in 2007, and I explained to them the 7-point plan that we had to counteract the violence and to counteract the mass incarceration of our people. And they said, well, Reverend Gannon, how are you going to go about doing this? And I told them, I said, we're going to have to educate. We're going to have to re-educate the people. And they said, well, how are you going to do that? Because we can't get them to come to church. They don't have, you know, back in the day, the church was the focal point of the black community. I said, well, we're going to have to reach them where they congregate at every day. We're going to have to, we have to pattern our ministry after the ministry of Jesus Christ, meaning that we're going to have to go and reach the people where they congregate every day. And they said, well, where they congregate at? I said, well, they congregate online. Where all the people congregate at now, they're on their cell phone, they're on their laptop, they're on their computers, they congregate, they're on their iPads, they congregate online. So what we did, we launched the first online campaign in the history of this country. We ran the first online campaign back in 2007, where we started using hard graphic posts, and we was on Black Planet, we was on MySpace, we was on all of these other multimedia things. And then when Facebook got started, we came on Facebook and we launched online campaigns talking about the problem facing Black America, and it was powerful. It was totally successful. When we had the first SCLC Stop the Violence and Incarceration Love Fest, we had an average of 500 people an hour that came through the Tupac Shakur Center for the Arts for the Stop the Violence campaign. And we did, 80% of that was done online, through online campaigns.
Oh, I didn't realize that you all worked with the Tupac Foundation, Tupac Shakur Foundation.
Yes, we did.
I'm aware.
Yes, uh-huh. Every year we did that.
His mother.
Uh-huh.
She's passed away. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so, all right. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yes, we did. I have things online that I could repost from those days when we were actually out there at the Tupac Shakur Center. And we started every campaign every year. We started at the Tupac Shakur Center for the Arts. Yes.
Oh, wow. That is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. I mean, I did not know that. Okay. So today we'll be talking about, we talked about depression and the veterans, and you yourself being a strong black man and how you were taught a certain way and in the military, and you didn't know that you were mentally ill. You thought you were being a strong black man. Okay, we got through that. We've talked about that. So now what I'd like to talk about, the decrease of crime and prison population all across America, concerning the war on drugs, which is, we both know that
okay.
The black people said 10 or 15 times, Reverend Gant, 10 or 15 times on this show that it's the war on black people, the war on drugs is, the decrease of crime. Now, when I told someone that I was going to do this show, they were very sarcastic. They said the reason there's a decrease in crime is because they put everybody in prison. They felt like only out of 10 people, 10 black people that were in prison, men and women, only two, maybe one or two belonged there. Everybody else had been set up, the frames had stuff did to them that made them look criminal. In the courtroom, they were criminals on paper, but in reality, they didn't do anything. Set up, things like that. So do you disagree?
I agree wholeheartedly, and I'm going to go a step further than that. In my 21 years of military service and my career in the Army, I was actually assigned to counter-drug operations for the United States of America. Before they had a DEA, before the DEA was started, when they launched this drug war, the military, we was in charge of counter-drug operations. And I worked as the NCOIC of counter-drug operation for the United States of America. And in that office, I saw the tactics of the drug war. I saw the tactics of the United States government, that the government, that our government had no intention, and I'm going on record saying this, that our government had no intentions of stopping the flow of drugs to America, but rather they had the intentions of controlling the flow of drugs to America. Back during the Cold War days, between Russia and Cuba and all the communist bloc nations, they were fighting against us. And so Russia came up with a plan. Russia came up with the plan that they were going to flood the communist bloc governments had a plan that they were going to flood the coast of the United States with drugs so that the United States could fall from the inside out, because they figured that most of Americans, they are drug addicts anyway. I mean, if you look at how much medical medication we take, if you look at how much drugs we take in this country, the average American, the high school students, the college students, everybody in America is experimenting or using some type of drug. So they came up with a strategy. The communist bloc came up with a strategy to flood our coast with drugs. So in order to counter that, the United States came up with a counter drug operation, with a counter drug cell that was inside of our military. I was a part of that counter drug operation cell. Now, when I saw, glory to God, and this breaks my heart. It breaks my heart, Angela Butler. It really breaks my heart every time I think about it. When I read that SOP, meaning our standard operational procedure for counter drug operation, it broke my heart. Why? Because they had a plan, and their plan was to use the drug war to fight the drug war in our communities, to make the black people take the fault for the drugs coming into the community, where we had no boats, we had no airplanes. You heard this before. We didn't have any tractor trailers. We had no ability of shipping drugs into our community. And as Colonel North, Oliver North, who went on trial for the drug cases back in them days, he told the truth. It was America and America's government that was controlling the flow of drugs in America. And they chose to fight the drug war not up on Buckhead, where the white people stay. They chose to fight the drug war down on Bankhead, where the black people stay. And that's what they did. They built the prison industrial complex. They filled up the jails. They pumped our communities with drugs and guns, and we took the blame. We took the fall for it.
Okay, the black community. So the war on drugs was ways to hurt black people and make us take the fall for it. They were the ones who were doing it, the military, the government, whatever. Okay. All right, you got on record saying it. Okay. What was your rank? May I ask, when you, after 21 years being in the military, what was your rank, sir?
I was E6.
E6? I don't know what that means. E6.
I was a staff sergeant. Then I had a break in service. And then I went back into the military as an E5. And then I came back up to the rank of an E6.
You were what now?
So I had a break in service after the Gulf War. I got out and then I came back in.
Okay. All right. Okay. E6. All right. So the decreasing of crime is not the only thing. Isn't there a decrease in the prison population?
I'm glad you brought that up. Since we started our Stop the Violence and Incarceration campaign, we have seen a decrease across the board. And the FBI report backs up everything that I'm saying to you right now. If you look at the crime reports of the FBI, you will see a continuous decrease in violent crimes. There's been a continuous decrease and crimes of opportunity, meaning like crimes of robbery, burglary, crimes of opportunity, those types of crimes. There's been a decrease in apprehensions, drug-related, because our people, the new generation that's coming up now, they don't want to sell dope. They done seen what happened to people selling drugs. They done seen what crack cocaine did to our community. They done seen what effect that drugs has had on our community. Now it has flipped the script. Now it's white children that's going to jail. No, they're not going to jail. It's white children that's being addicted to Molly, that's being addicted to the opioids. And now instead of them calling it a crime, now they're trying to seek for them to get mental health and for them to get mental health treatment instead of it being a crime as it was when the crack cocaine filled our community. They accuse us of being criminals. Now, since these are white kids that are coming up on these heroin, that's coming up on these opioids, now all of a sudden it's a nation crisis of mental health. And this is what we got to see, the hypocrisy of America, that when these little white boys go out here and they shoot up the whole school, where they say, well, he had a mental health problem. He wasn't taken care of well at home. Well, if the black kids come out there and they have gun violence with the Crips and the Bloods and the gang violence that we have, then all of a sudden we are criminals. But when it turns back on them, like how they're suffering from the opioids use today, now since it's affecting little white kids, now it's the nation's biggest problem. We're gonna have to come up with strategies for their mental health and to get them treatment as opposed to incarceration. They incarcerated us, but now they're putting them inside a drug program.
Okay. All right. So I agree with you. I agree 100%. I know that you're right. Racism is still strong in America. Some people are in denial. They say that people start trouble, that people are this and that, but it's the truth. It's racism.
Well, I'll go on record again. I'm backing you up on that. I will go on record again to say that America knows that the greatest terrorist force, the greatest terrorist threat we have in America right now today, and the news report backs this up. Their own news media backs this up. The greatest threat to America, terrorist threat to America right now, is a white American male. Not a Muslim from Iran, Iraq, or Shiite Muslim, or ISIS Muslim, no, they're not the threat to America. The greatest threat is not the Black Panthers or not any black racist, black racial group or anything like that. The greatest terroristic threat in America today is a white male. All of these shootings from Caliban on up, they were all white children. They were all white males. Everything that's been happening with these terroristic acts in America, they have all been perpetrated by white males. And I'll go on record as saying that.
All right. Okay. That makes you go on record said, okay. Once again, you said this before. That's not anything new. You go on record saying it, and so that means you have proof of some sort. So I believe you, of course. I do. So basically,
yeah,
I want to talk to you about the police bill of rights. And how did that come about? How did the police receive a bill of rights?
Okay. Well, most people don't know about the police bill of rights. But because that was my major. My major in college was criminal justice. Georgia Military College, and I went to K-State University. My major was in criminal justice, and what America doesn't know is that the police have a actual police bill of rights that protects them, that gives them the authority to go out and to enforce the laws of the states, cities, counties, and the different jurisdictions. And under this police bill of rights, this is what gives them the power to go out and to apprehend, to go out and to carry out the law enforcement that's necessary throughout you know, throughout that particular state, throughout that particular city, or that particular county. And they each, if you look it up online, you will find out that each one of them have a police, have a Bill of Rights for the police service. And then if you go further into the history of the police force, you will find out that it was started back in the days of slavery to control the runaway slaves and to control slave rebellions. They created militias, they created police forces to go out and to insert and to enforce the rights of you know, the dominance of the slave population. Because remember now, there were more slaves on the plantation than it was the actual owners. So they had to have a force in place to control that, to keep them in place, to keep them from rebelling. And that's if you look at the history of the police in America, that's where it came from. That's where it started at. And that's pretty much where we are today. Because you see the police patrolling in the black neighborhoods, you don't see them patrolling like that in the white neighborhood. The only way you see them in the white neighborhood, and I lived in a white neighborhood, is if we called them. That's the only time we saw a police. We didn't see a police riding up and down the street. We didn't see a police parked on the corner. We didn't see none of that inside of the neighborhood that I lived in out in Cobb County. But when I grew up in Atlanta, police everywhere.
Police were everywhere. Because
mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of black people are at.
That's right.
We have, 5 million people? Maybe 6 million?
I think it's closer to 6. I don't know. I think it's closer to 6 or 7. I can't recall because we have, I have to look that up.
Okay. All right. So I like what you've been doing with Stop the Violence and Incarceration with the children during the summer. I really think that's wonderful. And helping them become self-employed, the 18 and above or 16, whatever the legal age is, work. I think that's great too. But I also think that the reason there has been a change is because of the at-risk youth programs that have been started.
Mm-hmm.
Also by the reentry programs that people have started.
Okay.
Started.
Yes.
I think that's another thing. That's what I believe. So
well,
I'm looking at
I had a large part in that also, in the reentry program, because
okay.
That was no such thing until we started that years ago. We started talking about, hey, why you going to just let them out of jail with nowhere to go, no money, no nothing? And then what are they going to do? They're going to go back and start doing the same thing they were doing before. So we came up with that concept some years ago about creating reentry program for those coming out of the prison system. I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
That's okay. I enjoy listening to you. I always do. I was just going to say the United States right now has about 329 people, 256,465 on census.gov, the population count. Now, according to this, black people are up here in this country to about 17.9, if I'm not mistaken here. 17.9%. Yeah, it's 300. That's what they have on the U.S. Census.gov. This is July 4, 2018. There was 328,054,892. So now it's clicked over the clock to 384,662 million people. The reason this is important to me because back in 2010 during the census, it said 12%, maybe 12.5%, and now they're saying it's almost up to 18% black people in this country. So that's an improvement. So.
I don't believe in the accuracy of their report. And here's the reason why. I believe they're lying. I believe their whole report is a lie because they don't want to count the they're not counting the prison population, the population that they've have mass incarcerated. Then and then a lot of time when the consensus people went to the door to knock on the door, a lot of our people ran to the back room and they said, well, how many kids do y'all have staying here? They said, well, we only got two adults and three children or whatnot, or if they open the door at all. I believe that that based on the amount of enrollment in our public schools, it shows that the numbers are higher. It shows that they're trying to keep us shown as a minority in America when actually we are getting closer to being a majority in America, and that scares white people to death. That scares them to death, knowing that we are outpopulating them because the average white woman can only have about two children at the most. At the most, that's about all they're having, about two children. They're having problems. They're having complications even in childbirth. But, you know, you ride through the neighborhood, we see these girls, they got two in the stroller, they got three of them walking with them, and that's the average little black girl out there having three or four babies at a time. Some of them having six babies at a time.
That's not good. That's not good. Because they don't have fathers. They don't have fathers. And it makes it harder on the woman. But I understand what you're saying about the census count. I do understand.
That's right.
I don't agree that it's accurate either.
Because, okay.
But what I'm saying is that's not a good thing that they have that many children when there's no husband. No father.
The system was designed to remove the black man from the fathership. They're trying to mass incarcerate our black males. They're saying that the only way the girl can get welfare is if she say there's not a man in the house. You know, they're coming up with strategies to systematically remove the black male from the house. But what I'm seeing happening now through the churches, through the nonprofits, through people like you, Angela, that a strong consensus that we are bringing our families back together. Grandmama can help. You know, granddaddy can help. Uncle Charles can help. Uncle Ted can help. And now we're seeing our young people, my son, them generation. Look, I am amazed, Ms. Butler, every time I walk out here on these streets and I see these young boys, these young black men, they might have the dreads in their hair and they might have their little dreadlocks and all that stuff. But I see them out here pushing the scrollers. And when I stop them, I say, hey, young man, let me see that little man right there. Let me see that little baby there. And I start talking to them. I say, you know, I found out that a lot of these children are not even their biological children. But they are coming back. The black family is coming back. And the black family is coming back strong with our new generation because a lot of them were raised up by their mothers. They don't want to see another child raised up without a man in their life. So our young black men, they're taking the role. They're playing a powerful role in the upbringing of this new generation.
Okay. All right, that's wonderful to hear that young black men and hopefully older black men will step up to the plate too, preferably the natural fathers, but if not, then I think it's wonderful. That's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing that young black men are taking responsibility, even when it's not their children, because they love the woman or whatever the reason, the young woman.
Look at President Obama. I'm sorry. If you look at President Obama and Michelle Obama, I think that changed the moral consciousness of black America. That made us stand up.
Okay.
I mean,
all
to
right.
See that beautiful couple, I mean, I'll let you come in on that, but see that beautiful couple, they made a very powerful impression of the black family in America.
Yes, they did. Yes, seeing the black president, the beautiful family. Yes, President Barack Obama, He did. Him and Mrs. Wife, Miss Obama. They really did. He told the truth about that. That is the truth. They were beautiful. They're a beautiful family also. Beautiful black American family. So the Bill of Rights that the police have, you know, I know you've always said that no matter what, a white cop, a Hispanic cop, a black cop, they're a bad cop, they're just a bad cop. Bad cop.
Mm-hmm.
Understand? It doesn't matter if it's white, black, or Hispanic. But the Bill of Rights is in every, is in 50 states. Am I correct?
Yes.
Well, how, who passed it? President Clinton? Who?
No, it's just a standard. It's just a standard. It's just a standard procedure that they follow. They have to have the every police force has to have the right or the authority to exercise their law. They are basically they are citizen police. They are people from the community. They are citizens that have been given the power and the authority to police the general population, and they have to have a set of rights to protect them. You know, to give them authority to perform their job every day. You know, what gives them that Bill of Rights gives them the right to write the ticket. That Bill of Rights gives them the right, you know, to answer the call, to investigate the murder, to investigate the drug, to set up drug task force, to you know, to set up, you know, child protection, you know, child protection in the sense of, you know, human trafficking and white slavery and stuff of that, of those sorts. You know, that gives them the right to go out and to investigate these things. Now, as we see, like with ISIS and with immigration and with all the problems that we have today, they have to set up a task force to look into those type of things. So that Bill of Rights gives them that authority to be able to go out and police the neighborhoods, and it's a guideline for them to follow. The problem is most of them are not following. They are abusing that authority, and because nobody has put them in check, nobody has gone back to check what the Bill of Rights for the police actually says. They've been getting away with murder, literally, shooting down unarmed people in the street.
I believe that. I believe that they're killing black people. They really are. And it's wonderful to know as a black woman and as a black person, black woman, that things are getting better, at least where you're at. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. The black family is coming back, so that's wonderful. I still give you credit for it, okay? I give you a lot of credit for it there. I give you a lot of credit for it, a lot of credit for the things that are going on, because you were doing this like 25 years ago. I give you credit for that, for being one of the first, among the first to start this. About mass incarceration and things like you and Mr. James Coffin Jr.
Mm-hmm.
For coming on Show Talk with Angela Buck. Mr. James Coffin Jr. Also let me know about this. So I think it's great. And I hope
we've done
in my voice.
And we've done campaigns, man. We've done Stop the Violence campaigns in Miami. We did two campaigns in Miami. We was in Jacksonville. We've been in Savannah. We've been in Macon, Georgia. We've been all over in Alabama, and I mean, now people are running Stop the Violence campaigns all over the nation now, all over the nation. We, you know, I always use this term, and I want you all to think.
Do they go by Stop the Violence and Incarceration all over the nation? Do they go in your name, in that name or other names?
Well, by different names. They may say Stop the Violence, but it's going to say Stop the Violence. They're going to say Stop the Violence. And all of the SCLC chapters have some version of a Stop the Violence campaign in all of the states
thank
that we are in.
Again. Thank you. If no one tells you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, and Mr. James Coffin Jr. And the other reentry programs and at-risk youth programs, you know, thank you. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Huh?
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I think the revolution is just now starting. We're going to see more positive things that are going to come to pass. And right now there's a powerful enlightenment movement that is going on right now that is hosted by the Hebrew Israelites. They're coming out and they're educating the people about our role in the Bible, the role that Black people have played in the institution of our religion and our beliefs and all of that. So I believe that we're going to see a great change in America.
All right. Thank you for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler, Pastor Lionel Gant.
Thank you.